let me figure this out. Monday, check. Tuesday, check. Wednesday, check. Thursday. It's Friday.
Yeah.
It's Friday. It feels Friday, doesn't it?
It just very
feels
Friday.
Friday. And
how many days we're in this week?
I'm sorry?
10 or 15? How many days in the week?
Well, I don't know. The month of July had 372 days. I don't know how that happened, but it happened. And
so many books are going to come out.
Judy Patrick and I have a gentle bet, which is that Judy thinks that we're just beginning.
Oh, unfortunately think she's right.
That August will perhaps have 410 days in it, but we'll see what happens. Good morning, all. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We are thrilled that you are with us on this Friday edition. It is the second day of August. It's still a fresh month, so we haven't spoiled it quite yet, but we're on our way. We welcome you to be a part of our program, as always. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. People often say to me, oh my goodness, what are the letters like? Well, we read a good share of them. And the ones that we don't read, and I'll just give this a little behind-the-scenes factoid. The ones that we don't read, one of two things. Either they mimic what we have just read. So if somebody says, I don't like this because of this, 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 and this, and we just read something very similar to that, then we omit that. The other one is sometimes people just don't pre-read, and I really don't know what you're trying to say. There's verbs missing and words, and I don't know, and things are misspelled, and look, I do this all the time on my phone as I dictate to it. But if, you know, I can't read it because I don't know what it is. And the third reason, of course, is just they're nuts. So
we prefer weird.
They're weird. Okay. Just absolutely weird. And I don't know what quite to make. Yes, that's right, Teresa, in the loving way. But we do love our listeners and we do love your letters. And we get to many, many, many of them throughout the course of a morning. And we will do so today as well. Panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. We have a terrific group this morning. And I know I say that most days, and days that I don't say it, yeah, you can read into it. But
I feel flattered.
He's on fire today. On fire.
But I will say that if you, but we have a great group today, and I've been Wednesday, Thursday, those shows, the people we have are just so incredible and so amazing and so smart and so thoughtful, and today's group is no exception, so let me introduce them to you. We welcome public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois to the program. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Delighted to be here. To be here on this very exciting day after what happened last evening with our folks coming home. What a great day. Good news.
We will talk about that, of course, in depth in just a moment. We welcome Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Handler. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. You know, last Friday you aired an ad on, you aired a show on the Mad Magazine exhibit at the Norman Rockville, and I couldn't resist. So Monday, my wife and I ran out to Stockbridge, and I got to tell everyone, go. Like if you grew up any years between the 50s and the 2000s, you got to go. This is a great exhibit.
It's a really beautiful exhibit.
Such fun.
The audio documentary that we did, What Me Worry, is on our website, and you can download it and listen to it. Sarah LeDuc, myself, and the great Brian Shields, a voice from the past, who retired from this organization in 2019. But I pried him out of retirement to come and co-host this thing with me. And it was, oh my God, it was fun. But the exhibit was so great. The people we talked to were amazing. And I believe it's going to be on, I think it's this weekend or next weekend, it's going to be on CBS Sunday Morning, which
was,
I mean, not what we did, but the event itself,
fantastic,
of course. And so good for them. It's a lovely, beautiful exhibit and really something. I'm glad you...
45 minutes, easy drive, and it tells you why you need WAMC so much.
And Jim sent me a picture in front of the Alfred E. Newman sort of spoof of the famous Norman Rockwell looking at himself in the mirror painting, and he had a Spy versus Spy shirt on, and I thought, oh my goodness, that's a great shirt. A great shirt. Out of mothballs, you said.
I don't wear it that often, but this was such an opportunity.
No, it's perfect.
Right, yeah,
just great.
Were you a Mad Magazine kid? Did you read Mad
of
Magazine?
Course.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, Brian was great to bring, because the reason I wanted Brian to do it was, first of all, I hadn't seen Brian in a while, but also because Brian always used to quote Mad Magazine in the office. Mm-hmm. And he would say, you know, in 1973 there was an issue. And right. and when he got let loose in the exhibit, I swear he knew more than half the people who were there. It was amazing. We welcome partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman and Henna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert. Good morning, Sienna. How are you?
I got to say, it's been a hard couple of days. Yeah. I've been contemplating the age-old question, when did I turn black?
Right.
And I'm trying to figure it out.
So you said...
I love that. You are fabulous.
So are you looking
I'm
like...
so glad
like,
you're here.
Like photo evidence? Where right. you
photo
through?
Evidence? Was it a movie?
Yeah. And then...
What prop did it? Yeah.
I was like... Oh.
I hope someone adopts this as a title for something. It's just, and then she became black.
Exactly. It is just crazy. But it's been a little weird. it's hilarious, though. You kind of have to laugh at it.
I guess.
I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Don't cry.
That's right.
It was, I tell you, I had it on in the background. I was going through some stuff and I had it. And I just could not believe what I was listening to. I said, Joe, I mean, I said, before, you got to tune into this.
So I had an immediate reaction that was, this is Trump, like, finding a way to steal the headlines back, saying something so absurd that it would push Kamala off the front page, et cetera. And that saying it to the black journalists who, you know, he said basically what he said to the people who aren't going to vote for him, right? Let me say something that you're all going to quote everywhere to the people who are going to vote for me.
And I was thinking
it was crazy of me to think this. And then last night I was watching CNN, MSNBC, and Fox, and all three of them had people who said this.
I don't agree.
I don't think it was to be salacious. I think that's how he feels.
Oh, maybe, but I think you know, he started with "you're being rude to me," and then he went into.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Maybe we should talk about what we're talking about.
Well, no, I think. I mean, we'll obviously get to this eventually. I do think that it is. It's still hard to figure out exactly what would, you know, what the motivation is to say it. I agree with Sienna. I think he just feels that way and said it. I don't know how much thought goes into it, maybe more than we give him credit for. I don't know. I still haven't figured it out after all of these years. But I do think that the point that has been made by many commentators, which is the people in that room were not the audience for that, meaning that he was saying that to his people, not to the people in the audience. But by the same token, it's still... We just made the whole issue weird, and to Jim's point, if it was to take Kamala Harris out of the headlines, that did not work.
Well, but to take the politics out, in other words, it made it into a personal me versus her.
But she didn't really.
We'll get to this.
I meant
the serious part.
But I'm just saying that I think it was really, I think that's, I think it's really how he feels about being black and other, like, I think that's how Trump is. I don't think he was thinking about the base, who was in front of him. This is the way he approaches life. I mean, this is not the first time he said something like this. And we all knew this is what it was going to come to. It got there faster than we thought, right? You know what I mean? We all knew this is the kind of language he was going to use eventually. It's just, okay, week two. You know, and so here
well,
we go.
Well, week two and, six, we and 60 seconds into the yeah. event.
60 seconds into yeah. the event. So I think for us, I think as, you know, for people who were watching that as people of color, you know, a lot of people were upset that he was there in the first place, because the reason why those institutions are in place, like the National Association of Black Journalists, is to be a safe haven. I mean, part of their thing is to do no harm to the black communities. It's there to be there to help the systematic injustices in our system when it comes to journalism or what have you. And to have someone in that space doing harm, it's just, it's a lot of questioning going around. So those are the conversations you're seeing on the back end of that, is why did we think for a second that this would be a productive conversation?
But see, I really was so confused about that aspect of it. There was so much talk about the process, like should he have been allowed to be there, and was this strategery, as opposed to the substance, the holding stupidity. Him accountable for the substance of what he said. It's like he gets off the hook for the substance of what he said because, true. Oh, maybe it was strategic. And isn't that strategic? Or there's, you know, the sort of time span on whether or not they should have invited him. I mean, as opposed to saying,
what an idiot.
Rachel Scott, awesome question, you know, the first reporter from ABC. Finally, someone is really just asking an incredibly tight, can't wiggle out of it question, right? And in the process of trying to wiggle out of it, exposed him for what he was. Why isn't the analysis just listen to what he says? Because he's consistently said that stuff over time. And what it did was remind people, you know, there's been 4 years where it hasn't been up front and center because he's been off the stage. He just goes to his rallies. It's all glowing. He says crazy stuff. People give him a pass for it. But in 32 minutes, those reporters just brought to light a lot of the stuff that's, you know, we haven't been hearing lately.
I understand what you're saying. My only gentle pushback is that I think that a lot of the questions as to whether he should have been invited or not were made prior to his actually hitting the stage. And I think it's a fair question. I personally think if you have a society of any kind of journalist and you offer them the president, the former president of the United States and the front runner of the Republican Party, take it. You know, that's a get. And so it gives an opportunity for those questions that have been bottled up for many, many years to be asked and to see how they would be answered. It turns out not great.
Yeah. I mean, I understand why you would want someone there. I mean, I understand why you want the front runner there and to speak. But it's, you know, and especially in light of the fact that Vice President Harris wasn't given the same opportunity to you know, be live there. Like, she offered the opportunity and they did not allow it. I mean, that I think also was upsetting to see. But I also say that these things he says, and this is the reason why you hear there was a lot of apprehension when we talked about Vice President Harris running for president, is that it was this apprehension, this fear, and I can speak for myself as a person of color, a fear of dealing with these issues again. Here we go. Now every day we're going to be having to talk about our color and as a woman, what it's like. And this is what we're talking about. This is the debauchery that we're going to have to go through throughout this whole, you know, this whole campaign and dealing with these issues. And when did you turn black? And now it's a conversation that's on the news. And now we have to, you know, it's just, I think it's that in its essence that people are talking about when they say, why was he there? You knew he was going to rumble. He was going to ruffle some feathers. And here we go. You know, like, here it starts. And we didn't.
But what better place to basically confront him? And one of the things that I think got lost in all of the questions dealing with race, right, the first question was the most powerful, was further down the line when they asked him about the January 6th folks and should they have been, you know, what to do with them. And he, like, double and triple down on letting them out. And they asked the question in such a pointed way, specifically about the number of police officers who were harmed and the damage that was done. So, it's not some people who have been led to believe, oh, it's just a bunch of peaceful protesters, right? And I think his answer to that needs to be examined. But I think the opening question, she turned black. And then he keeps doing it by posting, stuff about her Indian, pictures of her with her Indian mother and that side of the family. Okay, you can be both. Wake up, buddy.
Well, that's the point he doesn't understand or refuses to understand, right? Or doesn't publicly understand.
But sort of here we go again. This is just a small thing compared to that, but I just, looked at the New York Times front page, and what's at the top right-hand side? Kamala Harris is dressed to be president. It's a story about what suit she wears. As a top story in the New York Times, are you kidding me? Seriously. I don't know. I'm sorry.
I hadn't seen it. I just saw it.
But
that is very.
But let me ask what's the really important political question on this? Is this going to help get people out to vote? Is this enough of an insult that people are going to say, "I'm getting off the damn couch"? And I mean, he's already had good turnout, but we were hearing that Biden was losing popularity among the minority communities, and now with Trump on this rage, will this get people to start saying, hey, we got to pay attention to politics and we got to go vote against this guy?
No, I think what was electrifying was Vice President Harris, coming out and Biden stepping down, and you saw that electricity.
Oh, yeah, well, sure.
And I think that's what's going to get people out. I think I do not credit him and his racial and offensive talk with getting people out to vote. I think people know that they don't want him to be, may not want him to be their president. But I think it's important to highlight it was last week when we felt that electricity.
Yeah.
And I don't think he brought more people out. I think he just solidified their decision, if anything else.
I think there is an incredibly, we have to go to a break. So let's do that. And then I will say what I think is an incredibly fine line. Right.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. I want to get back. Obviously, we want to talk about the prisoner release that happened and was ultimately completed as the prisoners were on U.S. soil last night. And I want to talk about that. We started off. As Sienna beautifully put it, we went rogue, and we started talking about the fallout from Trump's remarks at the Society of Black Journalists, and I just want to what I was saying is that there's a fine line, it seems, between we've always been talking on this show for years and years and years during the Biden administration. And before on Democrats of messaging and that the Democrats were not good on messaging. And what I have noticed over the last week, and I'm not saying that they have solved the problem, no, but what I am saying is that I find these press releases coming out of the Harris campaign each day where there is a rundown of all of the weird stuff that was said in the previous 24 hours from J.D. Vance, from the campaign, from Donald Trump himself. And I think a really gutsy sort of, well, just don't believe us, we're not taking this out of context, but here's a link to the entire article, is really cool. Also, and then responding to it, I think that is terrific and something that we haven't seen, because we keep on, I think Democrats kept on saying, well, are you going to go after this, the nuttiness, weirdness? So that's one. But the other fine line is what we were just talking about during the break was Kamala Harris speaking to the sorority group hours after Trump made his remarks in Chicago, and the way that was handled by her, which while the overt
While the overt tenor of her remark seems to be, we need to look them in the eye and fight, that in that particular case, she just said, same old show. Same old show. And just put it aside. And I thought beautifully acknowledged it, said it was inappropriate, said it was disrespectful, said it was divisive, and then moved on.
And we're better for our differences. We're better for our differences.
And it just struck me that, as I said, that's a hard thing to balance, of being tough and to fight and to look, but also then to take a higher road and get, because at the end of the day, how important is that? Because we all know who he is, what he is, and what the kinds of things that he says are.
Yeah, I thought it was terribly impactful. Like I said, I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge fan. I think she's handling herself very gracefully. And I think what she did was she kind of inadvertently, she reassured, even communities of color, like we're not going to let this distract us from what we're doing. I think that's what she did in essence. She said, we've seen this before and still we rise. Let's keep going. And I think that's the message that we had from Vice President Harris. And it was amazing.
Yeah, I firmly agree with you on the we're not going to let it distract us. That she didn't ignore it. She acknowledged it. She seemed presidential. He seemed petty and petulant. Right. And that it didn't distract from her core messages. Her core messages are ultimately hopeful and looking forward. And it's basically, we can go back to that kind of behavior, or we can move forward and get on with helping people in their own lives. And she didn't take the bait, but she didn't let it go either.
Yeah,
I thought it was an incredibly great job.
I don't think I realized how important, because I think we've forgotten over the years, but having her be the sitting vice president when she shows up, that's a show. Mm-hmm. The arrival, the pageantry, the campaign element of it, that this is just not another presidential candidate coming to your town. This is a visit by the Vice President of the United States. And that's I think that has been very impactful over the last several days.
I mean, I agree. I was on one of the calls. You know, we've been having all these calls lately that's been very productive, and you just listen to one of those. I was waiting to see if she would show up, and you start getting this, like, knot in your stomach because you're like, is the vice president going to show up? And, you know, I mean, it's there's this grandiose feeling to it. This is importance to it, and you lock it in with who she is as a person and her ability to communicate, and it's just a majestic moment. That's the way I describe it. All last week, I mean, prior to last week, there was this kind of cloud around politics. We were kind of like, what are we doing? What's going to happen in this upcoming election? And as soon as this happened, I felt like this cloud lift. And as someone that was very, very, you know, Joe, you know, I talked about on the show, very apprehensive about having Vice President Harris as the nominee. I was shocked and excited that, you know, we had this opportunity. And, like, the cloud lifted. And now I'm turning on the news and I'm happy again. I want to see the conversations. No, it's been a whole different vibe and energy into what's going on in politics. And it's before it felt more daunting and dire. And so I really think that's the energy she brings. And I think her doing it from a vice president posture versus senators are a big deal. Senator, you know, or campaigning posture is a big deal.
Well, and you listen to you compare that to the Republican National Convention where Trump, after his 20-minute, this was my ordeal, tragic, traumatic event, but after that just went off, and to this apocalyptic, the world, the country is as awful and is crumbling and deteriorating, and then to see over the last several days, over the last week, Kamala Harris go out and work the rope line
talking to kids and the communication that's going on of how excitement kids are, how excitement women are, how excitement men are, how excited people are, how she is laughing, how she's talking. I mean, that's a completely different vibe than anything we have seen in a really, 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 really long time.
It's a joyful campaign.
She looks like she's enjoying herself. My wife says this all the time. She's like, you know, all the other candidates we've seen for a lot of years now have always seemed, you know, it's all about being somber. It's all about being, quote, presidential. And the campaign isn't about being presidential. The campaign is about showing people who you are and getting them excited. And she's doing such a beautiful job of just saying, you know, we live in this wonderful country and let's
celebrate,
make it happen. And let's stop with this crap about divisiveness.
And the things that are
really
growing organically, really nice. I'm fascinated by. And the latest one that just is amazing to me is the Deadheads. They're having a call, right? And they're gathering together in, I don't remember the date, but they're having a whole thing around Grateful Dead. And there's going to be some music and some key Grateful Dead people who I'm sorry, maybe, are you a Grateful Dead aficionado, Jim?
I was.
I'm guessing yes.
I think he dabbles.
Anyway, I didn't understand all of it. I'm more James Taylor. Like, I want to go to the James Taylor phone call. But yeah. But anyway, just even that's like so okay, everybody, right?
It's grassroots energy,
right?
That's,
yeah. You know, bubbling up.
It's bubbling up. You can feel it. You know, you're figuring how to get involved if that's your, you know, political.
And it's funny.
And it's fun. Right. And it's funny. She laughs with her mouth. She's old. You know what I mean? It's just engaging. And you think about a few weeks ago when we had we were infighting, you know, about whether Biden should step down. And it was like, oh, what's going to happen? And, you know, it's just different.
White Dudes for Harris takes on a completely different tenor than White Dudes for Trump.
Right.
Which actually was an awesome call, by the way.
One is fun. The other one is like borderline Klan meeting.
Right. But the other thing that's happening is, and this has disturbed me over the while, sort of diminishing her role as vice president and, oh, you know, Biden didn't use her and what did she do? She wasn't doing anything. And what's come out in the last week is all this stuff, even around that, and I know we need to get to the prisoner swap, but her role in that, right? She had a vital role in it. She was very active. And there was another issue the other day when they were talking about the situation with Hamas and such and how she's in on all the daily briefs. And here, you know, Trump, when he was president,
barely
attended the daily briefs, the security briefing. And ironically, now is complaining because he doesn't get the daily brief. But there, you've seen over the last week, there's much more attention to what an important role she has played in a variety of issues, and that got minimized, and it wasn't true. And
But kudos to the Biden administration for including her and to embracing her and bringing her into that fold, and kudos to the Harris campaign for not feeling that could be a drag on the ticket. And that there is a question there that still has yet to be an answer of what is the Joe Biden effect, that they are embracing it and they are working together and they're doing the job that they were elected to
do. And this chatter, oh, well, she's going to have to carry the burden of the Biden record. Are you kidding me? It's not a burden.
Yeah.
It's a historic legislative record. I mean, even on this show that's been talked about, and I'm going to scream at the radio, he has an amazing record, and they you know, did it collectively. And it's not a burden. It's a, you know, it's a foundation on which she can help build her campaign. And, you know, all over the country, who's benefited from the infrastructure bill all over the country, who's benefited from the Inflation Reduction Act with the clean energy funding and such. And Jim, you know better than me, the CHIPS and Science Act, you know, all over the country.
Huge.
Reshoring, you know, it's in terms of igniting innovation and improving the workforce and all of that kind of stuff.
And
so
I will say to that, there was just another article, I think, about how the Silicon Valley CEOs are supporting her, and that's a response to that chip that you just mentioned.
All right. Let us take a break. When we come back, we will we'll end our half-hour tangent, and we will
go to the Harris Love Fest.
Yes, go to the subject that we wanted to start with today.
having to do with the exchange of prisoners yesterday and the what I would say triumphant arrival of them last night on U.S. soil. And look at the deal that led to this blockbuster exchange between the United States and Russia. We will continue our conversation with Jim Hendler, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Teresa Bourgeois, plus your questions, your emails, panel@wamc.org, and we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning. It is the 2nd of August. I'm Joe Donahue, along with Jim Hendler, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome your letters, as always, panel@wamc.org. Three Americans freed in a large-scale prisoner swap with Russia were welcomed home last night by both the president and the vice president of the United States as they arrived at Joint Base Andrews. Evan Gershkovich, Alsu Kermasheva, and Paul Whelan were greeted by the president and the vice president. Paul Whelan saluted as he emerged from the plane and walked down the steps into American soil. Next came Evan Gershkovich, smiling and looking slightly disbelieving on the tarmac. Alsu Kermasheva was last seized in a tight hug by her two daughters and husband after greeting President Biden and Vice President Harris. The three Americans who had all been imprisoned in Russia on charges criticized by the Biden administration as illegitimate were returning home after the largest prisoner exchange since the Cold War. Biden and Harris greeted them shortly before midnight on Thursday, where they were flown after the exchange took place in Turkey. Just looking back real quick about sort of what we know about the deal itself in reporting from the Washington Post. For the last 2 weeks, Biden administration officials were confident that they had finally secured a deal to release more than a dozen journalists, pro-democracy activists, and wrongfully detained Americans from Russian prisons. The negotiations had been painstaking and sometimes faltering, but now 16 people were on the verge of freedom, among them Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich. Meanwhile, Washington Post contributor Vladimir Kara-Mirza, among the most outspoken and trenchant critics of Russian President Vladimir Putin and Paul Whelan, a former Marine who had languished in Russian prisons for more than 5 years on trumped-up charges, also released. Officials in Washington who had helped craft the deal were buoyant as the Americans boarded a plane in Moscow, joined by a group of jailed Russian pro-democracy activists who would travel on to Germany. But until they touched down at an airport in Turkey and their heads were counted, their identities were verified, and they were physically out of Russia custody, U.S. officials kept their fingers crossed and remained, as several recalled, on pins and needles. There was a lot that could go wrong, and during this flight, it thankfully did not.
So, you know, there's so many spins on this story and so many ways to do it, but one of the things I found fascinating, as a time where the country had lost confidence in him, is saying Joe Biden can't hold this presidential position, okay? He made a critical call to the Slovenian president an hour and a half before he announced he wasn't going to run. A couple days later, he came down with COVID. While he was at home on COVID, he made the critical call to Chancellor Olaf Scholz of Germany. And Scholz is quoted publicly as saying, "Mr. Biden, I will do this for you." Right. You know, I mean, that was the critical lynch point, was there was one person Putin wanted to get back, was willing to, you know, make these trades for it. It turns out, by the way, as another story about how it didn't play well in Russia, that they felt, you know, he had really blown, you know, a lot of political clout for this, you know, not very important trade. So, I mean, you know, this was Biden at his best, while suffering COVID, after having made the most devastating decision of his life, I mean, well, or of his political life, it's just, you know, I've always felt that there was a lot more to him than people saw, and this one helped prove it. And then, as this came together, as you saw that Kamala had a very strong back office role in rebuilding the international trust. That's what Trump had lost, and that's what Biden did. And this shows why being able to work with other countries, look at all the countries that were involved, and just think about it. I mean, you know, we're talking NATO allies, but we're also talking, you know, NATO allies who are not necessarily our best friends, like Turkey. Just a lot of, let me call it real politic, went into this. A lot of thought, a lot of hard work, a lot of years, and to really pull it off. And meanwhile, Trump was like, hey, you know, first day I'm elected, I'm just going to call up Putin, he's going to release these guys. Right? It doesn't work like that. And this proves it. And this proves why you need a president who knows what they're doing. It proves why you need a team in the White House. I'm sorry, I'm going on too long. But the bottom line is, I think this was a staggering piece of political maneuvering.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when Brittany Griner was released in, I believe, 2022, and the president said, he said, we're still working on this. You know, when people doubted him on the news and said, what about the remaining people? Or he said, we're still working on this. We're working hard on this. And I think this is why President Biden's legacy will go down in history as really great, because no matter what, he put the country first, he kept his promises, and it's just an amazing feeling to see. I thought it was great.
And a quick call out to Brittany Griner for leading the women to yet another gold medal.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think that we have to applaud President Biden, and some people probably should call him and apologize. Imagine the distance inside the White House when they know he's doing this amazing work. At the same time, there's all of this public conversation about how he's incompetent and he, you know, can't run the country. But I just think that his skills really shone through, his connections, and Vice President Harris, and also his amazing team. And this particular deal started to come together in December of 2022. So that's how long they were working on this. But I thought it was interesting what Jake Sullivan, he did a press briefing yesterday, his national security advisor, who's awesome. He was saying that soon after President Biden was elected, before he took office, that he convened some of those people who, like Jake and others, who are going to work with him on these issues. And one of the first things he said is he wanted information on anybody from the U.S. who's a detainee who's been held hostage. And that he wanted to, from the get-go, have a plan to get them home. This was, you know, from the beginning, he was focused on not these particular people, but anybody, to have an infrastructure to all of government infrastructure. So I think it's also an affirmation that experience matters, diplomacy matters, and who you have in the government staff. I mean, you think about what Trump did to decimate the State Department and what Biden did to build it back up. And you also think about all the talk about Project 2025, which is politicizing these staff. But it was the incredible capacity of a lot of people in the CIA, people you don't ever hear about or think about, who made this work, and also re-knitting together our allies. I think that the story, the backstories, again, I think books will be written on this as well, but it was an incredible, complex act of diplomacy that they should be cheered for.
I will say...
The only thing I wanted to add to what Teresa said was Jake Sullivan speaking and becoming so emotional.
Right. And see how much this meant to him.
That the empathy and the true commitment to getting that done, right. I thought was very moving and very genuine and really kind of summed it up for me. I mean, this was obviously before we saw the images of anyone being released or the families reacting or even the president speaking on it. But it was an incredibly moving moment.
And the president speaking both at the White House and then at the reunion, when he was asked, well, you know, what's the importance of this? And he said, it's all about family. I mean, and for him, I think this is deeply personal. But it was I couldn't stop watching last night when they came together. And I just couldn't, like, holding my breath until the plane landed, because unless they're on the ground, you know.
Right.
It's not done until they're on
the ground. Until the door opens, you know.
And the plane safely lands.
I mean, I'm just, you know, and just speaking logistically, like someone that works in this area, it's so important when you do travel. Because everyone that was going to, in these people, they were convicted in those countries, right? And they were found in supposedly on charges that were unfounded, but they were convicted in those countries. And to know that your country stands behind you is so important when you're traveling into these countries, when you're trying to do free press and, you know, media. And, you know, it's so important to know that your embassy is behind you and you have a safe place to go. Mm-hmm. And when you don't have a government that's behind you, that can be very daunting when you travel. I don't know how many people register with the embassy when they're in different countries, but that's what you should do so that they know you're there if something happens. But this is, I mean, logistically, just real-time experience. If you're a traveler, this is important to know that your country is behind you.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Jim Hendler, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Teresa Bourgeois. We will have more of this conversation after news with Rick Graff. Well, good morning. We missed you, too. We are back. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you on what you think about the issues that we're discussing this morning. We do have letters. We also have Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Sienna Freeman-Tolbert here, and we will continue to hear their thoughts on the issues of the day. Before we move on, however, on other stuff, I would like to just catch up on some of the letters. Gus says, it's glorious, but please don't forget the man they left behind, the one who was arrested for possessing marijuana that had been prescribed to him by his doctor. This is in the prisoner exchange.
A teacher,
that's right. Then there is John. Why would Putin agree with this when it supports the Democrats and Putin wants Trump to win the next election? We have another letter similar to that that I wanted to get to. Obviously, the Trump response, this is from Lawrence, obviously the Trump response to the Russia prisoner exchange was unfortunate. My question is, if you're running for president and your opponent is the incumbent, secures a major hostage release, what is the appropriate response?
Well,
can I take the first part and you do the second?
Well, try the first, but I got one on that one, too. Go ahead.
So
there's enough for both of you.
Yeah, no. I want to hear it. I'm only going to repeat what somebody else said. So go ahead.
Well, I think the critical thing in the prisoner swap from, you know, again, I'm just things I've heard on the news, all I've been listening to, is that the whole thing hinged on Germany being willing to release, I forget his name, the person Putin really, really wanted, right? He had been...
The assassin.
The assassin. But it turns out, I mean, and it's been rumored that this guy was essentially Putin's chief of staff for a while. This was a personal friend. And it became pretty clear that there was no way in heck the Germans were going to let that guy go unless Biden did it. So the news I was hearing on some of the more international channels and things were saying it was Biden's personal involvement, Biden's being able to call up Oleg and say, you got to do this. And, you know, and then Putin was faced with a choice, because if he said no, then, you know, ain't no way Trump is getting the Germans to play.
Right.
He's insulted them left and right.
So Krasikov, intelligence operative. Michael McFaul, I heard him being interviewed last night, and he is a former U.S. ambassador to Russia. And when he was asked this question, he said that Putin was very pragmatic. He wanted Krasikov out, and that this was a very complex deal involving the United States, Germany, Poland, Slovenia, Norway, Russia, and Belarus, and that his speculation was that Putin understood that this was a very complex deal and that he was not confident that a Trump administration would be able to put together this the logistics, the mechanics of having this all work, and that he knew that Biden could, and he wanted it done. And so that is possibly why they did it now. And the other person that I thought was interesting on this was David Sanger. And he talked about a couple of things, the role of the CIA director, William Burns, who was key in this, and he was also the ambassador to Moscow. But he was reminding people that Trump had a very uneven, at best, relationship with Germany. Remember his fights with Angela Merkel. And so there is not there is a very negative relationship between Trump and Germany, and that those people who wanted to get this done felt that Biden has obviously a very close relationship, and that they needed to get this done now because of that Germany would not do this for Trump.
I just want to, real quick, this has something to do with what you were saying, but not a lot. But David Sanger, I think, is just doing an amazing job, brilliant, and doing an amazing job over the last several weeks and months over on these issues. He has a new book out called New Cold Wars. And I've started reading this, and it is this about America's plunge into all of these confrontations with various adversaries. And it is fascinating, endlessly fascinating. He's going to be at the Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont, on Saturday, August 24th at 6 o'clock. And if you get a chance to hear him speak, it's a real treat and a real event. He has ties to the area, to southern Vermont, so it's wonderful to have him there. But anyway, I just wanted to point out this new book, New Cold Wars, is the name of it, and it's just tremendous, absolutely fascinating stuff, and you'll learn a lot.
Can you repeat that date and time?
Sure. Of course. It is August 24th, Saturday, August 24th at 6 p.m., and you can find out more information by going to northshire.com, and it is at their Manchester, Vermont store. And the name of the book is New Cold Wars, which I believe has been out for a little while. But is just terrific.
His comments were so fascinating to me last night. And among other things, Trump had put out a statement saying, you know, that he would have gotten this done. But as David Sanger noted, and as President Biden noted later, that that Paul Whelan was seized during the Trump administration, and he didn't get him out then. So, you know, and it's he was held for more than 5 years, and that's just stunning. Imagine that, 5 years. But he also talked about Mark Vogel, and he talked about the importance of people like the CIA director, William Burns, who was the first career diplomat to serve as director of the CIA, that Biden, President Biden, elevated him in June of 2023. And that apparently the Russians would only be through the CIA back channels. That's all they would work with negotiating this deal, which I thought was interesting as well.
Here are three letters before we move on to other subjects that are on a range of things that I want to get to before we take on the next topic. Carrie writes, I wonder how people in Israel feel seeing Biden getting hostages home when Netanyahu hasn't gotten the Israeli hostages home. I wonder if this was Biden thumbing his nose a bit at Bibi with the timing of this.
While I think there's critique about Netanyahu and the hostages, the timing of this, as we've just heard in story after story, has been going on for over 2 years, right? October 7th had not even happened yet at the time this conversation was started. So you know, who knows what backroom diplomacy is going on. We do know that the Biden administration is working very hard to try to get a ceasefire prisoner release thing happening. And, of course, that's being made harder by the overall situation. You know, if we talk later about the leader of Hamas being killed.
They killed the the key Hamas negotiator.
Yeah, but, you know.
Sorry.
I don't know if we want to go off on this tangent, but Teresa, here's my thinking, right? October 7th proportionally killed more Israelis as a percentage of population than 9/11 did. This guy was the Osama bin Laden of that operation.
The Israelis killed the other day.
When the Obama administration took out Osama bin Laden, I didn't hear a lot of people saying, you know, that was terrible, that was awful, look what we're doing in the Middle East. And it had, you know, repercussions back and forth, up and down. But, you know, I think this was Israel, if they did it, you know, this was taking out the guy who killed the it's roughly the equivalent of this if he had killed 300,000 Americans. Right. Think about that.
Well, I also, just so the broader issue, I think that I know Fox News and the Trump team have been, I think, as a diversion, saying, well, Trump, the Biden administration is not doing anything to deal with the hostages, the Israeli hostages and U.S. hostages. But I think that that belies the facts. And I was interested to hear this morning that some of the families of the hostages have come out today saying that the Biden administration is working tirelessly to try to get this done. So I thought that was pretty impressive response to that. But before we leave this topic, can we just a moment on Alexei Navalny?
Sure.
So I think one of the side stories on this I was fascinated by was the role of Alexei Navalny.
Just you saying that makes me feel like I'm doing a real radio show. So a few things to say about it. No, I'm making fun of me.
Oh. Oh, I'm sorry. I know I'm a little wonky. That's putting it mildly.
Occasionally, I just bring up game show hosts, and you're like, oh, before we leave this, can we talk about Alexei Navalny? Yes. Yes, Teresa, we can. Absolutely.
So he was to be a critical component of this, and the Germany was very, very opposed, as we've talked about, to allowing this assassin to be released. But when President Biden suggested Navalny in the mix, then they were more receptive to it. But interestingly, once they got the word back to Russia that there would be a interest in working out a deal that included Navalny, within a week, Navalny was dead. And maybe a coincidence, maybe not. Somebody knows. I don't. But what was interesting to me is they kept at it, and they discovered that there were three of the dissidents who were close to Navalny, who, once they were added back into the mix, that that Germany then did agree, and it was, you know, Biden's recommendation. And so so three of the people who were released to Germany were these Russian dissidents who were a part of Navalny's team, and they now are also free, which I think is very, very important.
I just have two letters that I want to get to that came in the first half hour of the show when we were talking about Trump and the comments that he made on Wednesday. See who writes, I enjoy the roundtable and always look forward to listening. I listened intently when you called for Biden's resignation. Why aren't you requesting the same for Trump? He is clearly incompetent. Thanks. I would argue, that we did not call for Biden's resignation at any time. We did not have a meeting and vote and decide that we were, as an editorial board, decide that we were going to call for the resignation of President Biden. What we did do is discuss at length the many, the continuing faucet of people who came out on a regular basis to discuss their concerns and their belief that he should be leave the race. And we did discuss that, as Sienna mentioned a few moments ago. This was not something she was for. But, you know, we covered it and we talked about it as far as the day-to-day drip, those three incredible weeks of the discussions and what went into it and then the machinations. And Teresa was a long time saying it's going to happen. They just have to get all their ducks in a row. And so I don't think we were ever... I know we were never calling for his resignation, nor would we call for Trump's resignation. But I would then quickly say,
we can't call for Trump's resignation.
But when you hear, but well, from leaving,
but there was a drumbeat.
from leaving the ticket, there was a drumbeat.
There was a drumbeat.
Absolutely,
so
and we were. Well, I think we were reporting on the drumming.
I think
we were commenting on the drumming. I don't think we were advocating. But I would say. Well, and even if we were, there were people who were for it. There were people who were against it.
Yeah.
My point is that I don't see we are not reacting to anything on the Trump level because no one within the highest levels of the Republican Party have said word one about replacing their candidate.
I was just going to say, and you know, where the Republicans are really more worried is Vance, and they're still sticking up for him. They're calling out saying, you know, he just hasn't the experience, you know, he's being misquoted, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
All right, we'll get to that in a minute.
But I was just going to say, but in other words, we as a crowd, you know, I certainly on this show met several times said, you know, I thought the Democrats were really hurting themselves by the whole way they were publicly dealing with Biden. That said, as it turned out, I am not unhappy.
But publicly shaming him the way they did. But I think on the Republican side, it gets to, and I just, you know, I'm a broken record on this, it gets to the role of the enablers. Because I think Trump is bad. I think the enablers are the serious problem. Because in the past, Republicans, as we saw with Nixon, you know, I've said this over and over, Howard Baker and a group of Republicans went to the White House and said, this doesn't work in America. You can't do this. You need to go, right? And he resigned. And... what's happened on the Republican side is right after January 6th, when you saw, okay, this is, you know, this is one step too far, even that. First 24, 48 hours, they condemned him. Stefanik did, and, you know, Mitch McConnell did, and everybody else did. But then they started visiting Mar-a-Lago, and then the word went out. And then all of a sudden, you know, I hear nothing, I see nothing. And that's the difference that the enablers have allowed this to continue.
He has three criminal trials. I mean, he's been convicted, and there's no movement. So to me, it's just, it seems like a conversation that they already had this conversation when they nominated him. They already dealt with this.
And I will say that if you look at in the broadest sense of the term, in the broadest sense, I think for the last 9 years we have been calling for him to step aside.
Well, I mean, we used to have a guy who sat here and said, "Lying, liar, liar."
Right. I mean, as I said, we don't all agree on that, but we do. You know, I do think that there certainly has been a lot of time spent on these airwaves of talking about the problematic nature of the Trump
how weird he is.
Presidency. Yes,
how weird. Very weird.
So my favorite line after his Fox and Friends morning news thing the other day when he just went on a tirade and it was almost incoherent when the Harris team just put out, "Is he okay?"
Yeah.
I love that.
Everything all right?
The other thing that's become very interesting is there's a lot of things Trump does that are very, very visible and make the headlines. And then there's a lot of things he's been doing quietly in the background that I find fascinating. That whole thing about the shark and the electric battery and all that stuff, you know, was really about anti-electric cars, right? Guess who just told him he was going to stop giving $45 million a month unless Trump started supporting electronic cars, Elon Musk.
Right.
Guess what? Trump just came out with a statement in favor of electronic cars.
Well, same with Bitcoin. He hated Bitcoin. He hated Bitcoin. I don't understand Bitcoin. I'm sorry. I'm an old lady. I don't get it. But, you know, he hated Bitcoin. Yeah. He hated Bitcoin. The Bitcoin folks, he's transactional. They're going to give him a bunch of the oil and gas people, right?
I was just pitched an author who wrote a book about Bitcoin, and they said, by the end of this, you will fully understand Bitcoin. And I said, well, I'm committed to doing this, but I guarantee you I will not fully understand
Oh, I'm glad it's not just me. All I know is it's a huge energy suck because it's, it's just...
Let's not even go there.
Okay, we won't go there. But
it's an energy suck because of how Bitcoin per se works, not because cryptocurrencies per se. But anyway...
tell us more,
Jim. All that said... No. all that said, let's not go there. But again, it's the
flip-flop. Tell us what you know about crypto in 90 seconds, okay?
Joe, it's not a problem. I believe I have a Vox Pop scheduled with Ray for next week.
Take a full hour. I love this letter from Bill because he's absolutely right that in all of our coverage here on this program of Trump's remarks to the Society of Black Journalists, you know, there was so much crazy that was dispensed, whether it be about his vice president, whether it be about whether it be about January 6th,
that answer needs more attention. Sorry, go ahead.
Bill says, please don't forget the black jobs that the migrants are coming to take line. Unreal times that we will overcome. And the reporter just on cue, I'm sorry, what's a black job?
See, like, this is why job? It was so good that they did it, because right there they could just come back at him.
Well, no, I'm just looking at Sienna. I mean, you know, here she's got this black job. They're going to come
take away her job as
a lawyer. Yes. Who's that amazing?
Apparently this is a black job. I Oh my God!
Where did you get
blown.
Your black?
Stupid.
Yeah. Where did you get your black degree?
Well, this is going down a road.
I mean, we're laughing about it, but it's just beyond rude.
It's so rude.
It's so nasty. The way he spoke to even calling her nasty. It was just.
Yeah.
It's just.
It's nasty. It's his go-to word for women.
If he thought for a second that he was growing his black base, that is not what happened after that interview.
Talking about black jobs.
You know what it...
So, Bill, I just want to thank Bill for bringing that up.
Thank you, Bill. There
was so much
packed
into that it's hard to extricate. I believe Jake Tapper on the lead that day said, we have 10 lead stories. And they're all from this one event.
That's it.
that just gives you an idea. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll have our last go around as a panel. We welcome you. Last chance to get your letters in. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be back after news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. About 15 minutes with our group this morning. Left before we continue with the program, and we welcome you, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, our last moments with Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Henwer.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
What?
Finish.
Okay. Sandra Freeman Hulbert and Jim Henwer, yes.
I was just going to say, we're talking off air here. I was like, it's not the black jobs that gets a lot of people, at least for me. It's not the turning black, because all those things are fallacies and we don't care. I think for a lot of people, it's the DEI hires. That's what, when you call someone a DEI hire, that questions whether they receive the job on their own accord. And I think that's what's really hurtful when he says that, and that kind of, it makes everyone take a second glance at a person of color in their position, wherever they're at.
And
that's really powerful, and that's what's really hurtful, I think.
And the "and she turned black" line came out of the answer to that question.
Exactly.
Is she a DEI hire?
Exactly. And I think that was the most hurtful, harmful thing that's been going around the Republican Party, I can say. And that's one of the most hurtful and harmful things he said at that event.
Well, I would also, amen. And let's also add the anti-Trump the anti-trans.
Oh, of course.
The whole anti-gay marriage. I mean, it's just, I feel like it's the 1920s, 1930s kind of era of craziness. And he's just building that divisiveness over everything that, if you're not a married white couple with your 2.4 or whatever the current number is kids, like, you shouldn't be here in America. And it's insane.
And a golden retriever named Alex.
So hopefully this will motivate people to get out there, get registered, vote. I mean, that's the thing. Because there's so much energy that's been coming.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's just been an amazing amount of energy, and this is what, only a week? How long did I spend? Not very much time.
When I took my hand and put it over in your direction, it wasn't to stop you. I was going to stir you up.
Okay.
And this is how I was going to do that. I was going to say this, which is, so we look at Project 2025. All right. And the administration, or the Trump campaign, we should say, is working very hard to distance itself from Project 2025. Meanwhile, yesterday I get a text from my dear friend Teresa, who says, "Have you seen this?" Which is one of the chief authors of Project 2025, who has written a book, has the foreword of the book written by a guy named J.D. Vance, who happens to be Trump's running mate on the Republican side. Teresa, I'll turn it to you.
Right. So this I found stunning. Right. So his name is Kevin Roberts, leader of the Project 2025, and he has a book coming out. And I saw this in both the New Republic and the Guardian had stories about this, and it has a foreword. And he, in the foreword, let me just get to the, since we don't have a lot of time.
The foreword written by J.D. Vance.
Foreword written by, it talks about, it's time to circle the wagons and load the muskets. Basically, he talks about the importance of this guy's philosophy, the importance of having an active agenda, and how it needs to not just be talked about, but it needs to be implemented. And it closes with, it's time to circle the wagons and load the muskets. That's what the author wrote. And J.D. Vance, in his foreword, restates that and basically says, you know, it's time to, you know, let's go. And what it reminded me of was at the National Association of Black Journalists event where Trump, his response continued, you know, he was questioned about, what do we do about the January 6th folks? And he's, let's free them, you know. And then it goes back to the 2020 remarks to the Proud Boys, stand back is stand by. So Trump can say all he wants that, oh, I don't know anything about this, I haven't read it, but then goes on to say it's crazy, right? And he disavows it. But 140 of his various advisors and staff people were involved in drafting it and engaged in writing it. And now there's a book to advance the basic concepts of it, and the foreword is written by his vice presidential pick, J.D. Vance. And I encourage people to go to The Guardian or go to and just read it. Read the foreword, because it is striking. And among other things, he talks about a private company that can censor, this Jim is for you, a private company that can censor speech, influence elections, and work seamlessly with intelligence services and other federal bureaucracies deserves a scrutiny of the right, not its support. And so I think he's talking there about, you know, Meta and Google, right?
Yeah.
But couldn't the same be said for Truth Social and X and so on and so forth? I mean, the detail, we don't have time to go through all the detail in this, but it is stunning. People really need to pay attention to Project 2025. Yeah. They need to pay attention to this because guys are serious.
Yeah. So for what it's worth, Teresa, I've almost given up. I still occasionally will track some of the spider webs in the corner of the World Wide Web, the deep stuff, but particularly not the ones that are like in the secret places. Things like, it's called 8chan. A lot of these things are still kind of, they are just scarily. You know, I hate to use the word insane because it would be insulting to people who actually have a mental disability. But these guys, it's like, you know, this is where the Q conspiracy and stuff originally started, but it's gotten so much worse. It's gotten to the point where I can't even read this stuff without my stomach turning. And that's coming from middle position. I mean, I consider myself sort of middle left, not, you know, super progressive or anything.
So he,
but, oh my God!
Right,
things.
But now he's the vice. So here, quoting,
I know,
the
I
old
know.
Conservative movement argued. I'm quoting here. Yeah. The old conservative movement argued, if you just got government out of the way, natural forces would resolve problems. We are no longer in this situation and must take a different approach. Vance writes, as Kevin Roberts writes, quote, it's fine to take a laissez-faire approach when you are in the safety of the sunshine, but when the twilight descends and you hear the wolves, you've got to circle the wagons and load the muskets. And now Vance writes, quote, we are now all realizing that it's time to circle the wagons and load the muskets. Yep. In the fight to lay ahead, these ideas are an essential weapon. This is the vice presidential candidate, and this is how he's talking about the ideas that are essentially in parallel with what's yep. laid out in Project. They say that this is a fight. And we all need to wake up to the kinds of things that they're proposing because it's restructuring our government and our democracy.
I don't want any fight, and I don't want, and all I want is peace. But if they're going to do it, just keep it at muskets.
But this call to
right?
arms.
I mean, you know,
what did Trump say after he got shot? I know everybody thinks I'm terrible for saying this. He didn't put a thumbs up. I'm okay. He said, fight, fight, fight. Right?
Right.
And what was his call at the January 6th speech, right? And this call to arms, it's dangerous. I'm sorry. You did fire me up. I just think this is...
Well, that's what I intend to
do. It worked. It works. I just, you know...
Joe knows good radio.
Sorry. People need to pay attention to this because these folks are in a position of power and the usual forces that check them are not checking them on this.
J.D. Vance is the most politically inexperienced GOP vice presidential nominee in almost 90 years, according to the Washington Post. He's run in just one election for any political office. Josh Hawley, a senator, a Republican from Missouri. You know, he's gotten shot out of a cannon. It's like going from 0 to 60 in terms of intensity, publicity, scrutiny, all that stuff. That according to Josh Hawley. Senator Ted Cruz, the Republican from Texas, says, enduring the demonization of the national media is never easy, said Cruz, who embraced the anti-establishment posture a decade before Vance arrived in the Senate. I will say this. If the New York Times were praising J.D. Vance, I would view that as a much, much bigger problem. Some of his Senate Republican colleagues think that's understating the firestorm in which Vance now finds himself in, not surprisingly. Both Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, who have yet to endorse Trump or Vance, said that they believe that his remarks are problematic and offensive to me as a woman, quote, end quote. Women make their own determinations as to whether or not they're going to have children, Lisa Murkowski told reporters. He is the second youngest of 100 senators. His selection as Trump's running mate has prompted deeper looks at his years spent as a best-selling author who served as provocateur on his many cable TV appearances. In his early 30s, during his anti-Trump era, to be 30 and to have eras, Vance compared Trump to cultural heroin and found the GOP presidential contender to be noxious. By the time he launched his first campaign 3 years ago, Vance kept his firebrand routine in his bid to convince the ex-president of his newfound MAGA embrace.
Yesterday, he was at the border, not answering questions about why the Senate didn't take up the border bill, you know, because we know why they didn't, because Trump killed the bipartisan border bill. But among other things, he called Vice President Harris a chameleon. And so I looked up in Webster's the definition of chameleon, and it's a person who changes his or her, changes color, but it's also a person who often changes his or her beliefs or behavior in order to please others or to succeed, which sort of defines himself. But it's also a section there that says, did you know? The chameleon is best known for ability to change colors. However, it's from Latin and Greek, a combination of chami, which is on the ground, and leon, which is a lion, a tribute to the lizard's fearsome aspects. So maybe he was saying she was fearsome.
And while he was at the border yesterday, he was also avoiding the vote in the Senate for the child tax credit expansion, which she promotes how much she, you know, important children are to our future.
That's right.
And the Republicans don't support it. Right.
Well, and also was really, even though the president wasn't overly supportive in his remarks in Chicago on Wednesday about his vice presidential pick, Vance was supportive of President Trump's remarks regarding Kamala Harris and saying they were on base. So there is that as well.
You know, I think if Biden had not left the race, Vance would have been actually a pretty clever pick, just because you needed someone who could be the second attack dog, could take on Kamala, things like that. But now with the change in it, he's so wrong.
It's reckless. He's not
and
qualified.
And it's scary. Well, of course. And Trump, you know, people keep talking about Trump's vitality. Trump is old. I mean, anyway, let's not go there.
Okay. We won't because we don't have any time. But I thank you all. Have a beautiful weekend. We'll be right back.